From this to motivate how the corresponding potential in supergravity is derived. So in the first, probably first lecture, or maybe one and a half lectures, I will get to, or maybe the first lecture, to the potential for the so-called F-curves. And in the second lecture, I will discuss the coupling of gauge fields. Global and local supersymmetry, and then we want to discuss the heat contribution to the potential. And in particular, I will discuss the relation between D-term contribution and F-term contribution to the potential, which seems to have been forgotten by even experts in the subject, but became relevant in recent work connected with KKLT type potentials. Then three, I will discuss the derivation of potentials in type 2B string theory. I should mention. Here I will also discuss Weyl invariance and Weyl anomalies, and the derivation of non-perturbative terms in the superpotential, the so-called Veneziano-Yankelevich superpotential. And so all these are ingredients which go into the recent work on GKP, KKLT type potentials coming from string theory. So in 3 and 4, I will discuss the potentials in B, following the work of GKP, KKLT, and finally I get down to how potentials for light moduli by integrating out heavy moduli. Which have been used by people to these potentials for light moduli have been used recently to discuss cosmology, getting inflation and so on from string theory. So that's roughly a summary of what I'm trying to do. So my notes, a preliminary version, which still, I'm afraid, fair number of typos, or will be posted on the web.
Certainly.
Okay.
And we're all expected to read them in detail.
That's right. And that's exactly right. That was the purpose. Okay, so first two lectures it's not going to be visible. The first two lectures will be based heavily on classic textbooks, Wells plus Bagger, and the paper and the textbook by Gates, Richelieu, Project and Siegel. This, I think most people are familiar with the first book. The second book is a rather difficult read, but there are lots of stuff in it which people keep rediscovering. In fact, this, what I mentioned earlier about the relation between D and F and Z is hidden somewhere in that book. I will use the notation from this, and I assume people are familiar with N equals 1 superspace, but I will go through the derivation of the potential just to set the stage. Okay. So why is this relevant to string theory? Well, in string theory, of course, consistent string theory has to have some supersymmetry. Phenomenology requires us that the four-dimensional effective action should have no more than n equals 1 supersymmetry, because the world is chiral. Because string theory is an asymmetric theory, and what we can get from, at least I formulated today, after now, what all we can do is to construct backgrounds and look for fluctuations around those backgrounds. And for phenomenological reasons, one might want to get n equals 1 background in four dimensions. So you compactify on some manifold, like a Calabi-Yau manifold, so that there is just one killing spinner on the manifold, so that you might get n equals 1 supersymmetry in four dimensions. And you look for the supersymmetric vector, but then you know that the fluctuations around this supersymmetric vector should fall into supersymmetric multiplets, and since we are talking about local supersymmetry, you should the nonlinear version of this linearized theory should be some n equals 1 supergravity. So once you motivate the n equals 1 supergravity that way, then you can first look for supersymmetric breaking solutions of your n equals 1 supergravity. And it is interesting to study this potential which comes from n equals 1 supergravity. Of course, there is no direct derivation of this nonlinear the nonlinear supergravity, and the argument is simply that the linearized fluctuations must organize themselves into this n equals 1 nonlinear action. Let's begin with the n equals 1 case. So we have so So I have superchargers Q alpha and complex conjugate ones, which satisfy the super algebra Q alpha cube. We can talk because to I sigma alpha alpha dot and dm, where q alpha and so on. Well, I'm not going to write all of this down, I'm just writing these out just to set, to define, get my notations right. So this is a linear combination of theta derivative, where theta is a Grassmann parameters, and so this is a linear combination of a Grassmann derivative and a space-time derivative, alpha dot theta bar alpha dot times dm. And there is, and then you have the Q's and the Q's. The Q's anticommit with the Q's. Q bars anticommit with the Q bars. And you can also introduce, well, one can think of these as carrying out left translations, and then you have operators that can carry out right translations, which are similarly defined. D alpha is D by D theta alpha plus I sigma alpha alpha dot M theta bar alpha dot times dm. Yes. And these, so the advantages of these is if you define these to be the supersymmetric generators, these things anti-commute with the Q's, so you can use these to define to get irreducible representations of supersymmetric. So the general superfield phi, general superfield will contain terms without theta scalar terms and theta terms, theta square terms, theta bar square terms, and so on. This is a general superfield, is a reducible representation, and it's useful to construct irreducible representations. And the simplest one is the chiral superfield, which satisfies B alpha dot bar phi equals zero, where phi is so phi is a function of x and theta, where x is space-time variable, and this is a of y plus square root of 2 times theta alpha psi alpha of x, where psi is a y fermion, a two-component y fermion. So alphas go over 1 and 2, and m go over 0, 1, 2, 3, that's the space-time index. So plus there is also what's called an auxiliary field, it's alpha theta alpha times f of y, where y is Ym is Sm plus I theta sigma m theta bar. And this is a solution of this constraint equation d alpha dot phi equals zero, where d alpha dot is this operator, well, I'm sorry, the complex conjugate of this operator here. So this is a chiral superfield, and it's the simplest irreducible representation of supersymmetric. And with this, we can construct a global.
Is the fermion also a function of y?
Oh, yes, it should be.
Yes, sorry. So this guy, if you look at the action of the cues on these components, you find that this guy, the transformation of the highest weight field here, the F term, the so-called auxiliary field, that this transforms into a total derivative, space-time total derivative. So that it's easy to construct globally supersymmetric actions. Maybe I should also mention the next one, which is the real superfield. The next simplest irreducible representation is the real superfield, traditionally denoted by V, which satisfy V equals V bar, or V complex conjugate. V has components, C, chi bar, alpha dot, and lambda alpha bar, alpha dot, Vm, and D. The physical degrees of freedom are just the fermions here. These are so-called gauginos, and this would be a vector, real vector field. This condition here is ambiguous up to a gauge transformation. I think I've been using dagger here, so where lambda is a chiral superfield, namely d bar alpha dot is equal to zero. So obviously this still satisfies this. I have taken this to be minus I. How did I get this? So you can eliminate using this, you can eliminate all of these guys and go to what is called the Vezzumino gauge. So that the superfield starts here, but if you want to preserve explicit supersymmetry, then you should not fix this gauge. Again, the highest component here is the so-called D term. That's also an auxiliary field, and that has the same property that, well, if you look at the transformation actions of Qs on this field, you find that this guy also transforms into a total derivative. And therefore, the space-time integral will be invariant. So now it's easy to construct action which is globally supersymmetric, and that simply S is d4x. Well, let's just construct an action for chiral superfields. So before I write it down, so we should note that a product of two chiral superfields is still chiral. So phi squared, phi cubed, or phi times psi, if both are chiral superfields, that's still chiral. So products of chiral superfields chiral. But a product of a chiral and an anti-chiral field would be like phi times phi bar would be a real superfield. So we can construct an invariant action by simply writing under the space-time integral a d4 theta times something which is a real superfield plus d2 theta times some chiral superfield where w is just a sum of products of phi and w bar phi bar is sum of products of phi bar. Note that under the space-time integration, the d2 theta bar can be replaced by a minus a quarter d bar squared under integral sign. So the d bar, so d is this fermionic derivative plus some space time derivative. So under the space, we are assuming that all boundary terms can be set to zero. So under the space time integration, this is the same thing as integrating twice with respect to theta bar. So remember that an integral of theta bar, integral of d theta is like differentiating with respect to theta, so on, and of course theta squared equals zero, so on, and integral d theta is zero, integral d theta times theta is one, okay. So basically what this integral tells you is that this d4 theta integral is just projects the highest component of k, that means the d term of k, so d, so this remember is the real superfield. This d alpha of phi is equal to 0, and k is equal to k bar. So d alpha of w is 0 because w is just a function, I'm sorry, I should say d bar alpha dot. So w is also chiral superfield. So this is an instruction to project out the highest component of k. This is an instruction to project out the highest component of the chiral field. In other words, I can alternatively rewrite this action as the f term of, sorry, the d term of k plus the f term of w. Okay, that's the highest term here. And similarly, the f term, f bar term of w bar. Okay, and since the d term, the transformation and the supersymmetry of the d term is a total derivative, similarly, the f term is a total derivative under the d for x integration, this is supersymmetric. Okay. In fact, it's convenient, as I said, this under the integration sign, this is the same as that, and you can alternatively redefine what we mean by somebody taller than me. We can redefine, it's convenient in fact to redefine what I mean by the scalar field as, so the scalar field should be redefined as phi at theta equals theta by equals 0. The fermion is 2 times d alpha phi. So from now on, when I write a bar like that, that means I do whatever differentiations I need to do and then set the theta and the theta bar to 0. Okay? And final f is minus a quarter d alpha phi. So this can be alternatively written as the f term of this, the d term of this and the f term of that. Okay, so from this you can explicitly work out the scalar potential. You just do the differentiations here. So this is the same thing as, so this d4 theta integration is the same thing as, I can rewrite this as minus a quarter d bar squared times a minus a quarter d squared. So for instance, if I do these two differentiations here and just keep the scalar features. So I would also get fermionic features first. So if I take, say, one d derivative here, I get a k by dk by d phi, and then the derivative acting on that is a d alpha, this is a d alpha on the phi, which is fermion. But if I act again with d on the d alpha phi, I get a d squared, which is again a scalar, or well, in that case an auxiliary field. So for instance, d bar squared, d squared on the k will give me a k ij bar times d squared phi. So let me now generalize this. So this, obviously everything I've said will apply not just to one chiral superfield, but to a set of them. So let me replace this by a set of such fields and define di to be the differentiation with respect to one of them. So this is kij bar d squared phi I d bar squared phi j bar plus fermion terms. So if I just keep these fermion terms and set, just keep these scalar terms, then I get from this action the potential, well, the action will give you minus the potential. So what I would get is, let me call it curly V since I used straight V for the gauge field. So what I get is minus V is K ij bar times Fi Fj bar. So let's remember d squared phi I up to a factor quarter is the F term. Minus Fi K ij bar times Fj bar. So this one comes from the first term, next one comes from here. I should say, so that this one is, the next term is skip the step here, This one would be W dW by dphi, or W phi, WI times FI minus its complex conjugate, I bar times F bar I bar. Now you can solve for the auxiliary fields and plug that back in here, and then you get three terms. Let me write them out explicitly because it's useful to observe the following. So rewrite this in terms of, let me solve for the WI first, just so solving this is because I have used the auxiliary condition, which I have get by solving this equation for the FIs. You get FI equals KI J bar DJ bar W. Plug that back in here. So notice that I get the same term from each of them, except that this one comes with the reverse sign. So this is just minus one of them. So mu, therefore, is same thing as plus Kij bar Fi Fj bar, which is the same thing as Kij bar times Wi times W bar J bar. So I could have got the potential just by evaluating this one, or this one, or this one, and changing the sign. Okay. Okay, so now let's derive the equations of motion directly in superspace. That's going to be useful for us. So let me rewrite this action, this one here. Let me use the replacement d2 theta is a minus a quarter d bar squared. Let me take the d2 theta bar and replace it by minus a quarter d bar squared. And therefore, I can rewrite this action as d4x times integral d2 theta times minus a quarter d bar squared k of phi bar plus w of phi plus the integral b to theta bar of w bar of phi bar. And vary this with respect to phi and set it to zero. So in varying with respect to phi, the phi goes through the d bar because phi is a chiral scalar. I get immediately that minus quarter d bar squared ki is equal to minus wi. Which I can expand as quarter K I J bar. So do the differentiation inside here, and I get D bar squared by J bar, squared by J bar, plus quarter K. So I just go through this once. J bar L bar D alpha dot bar phi bar J bar times D bar alpha dot phi bar L bar equals dW by D phi. So, and then if I, so this is just, I'm working through this one, working and keeping all the terms here. If I set theta to theta bar equal to zero, then I pick up the equation which I get the equation which I had before. So if I set theta equals theta bar equal to zero in this, then I get F bar J bar, that's the minus a quarter D bar squared phi J bar is minus K J bar I times W I plus fermionic terms coming from here. If I differentiate once with respect to alpha and then set theta to zero, then I get the fermionic equation. So if I differentiate once with respect to alpha and then do the d alpha on the equation and then set theta to zero, I get the fermionic equation. And finally, once more, in other words, differentiate respect to d alpha, d squared, and then set theta to zero, I will get the scalar field equation using the identity that acting on chiral fields, d squared, d naught squared, d squared acting on a chiral field is the same as box phi. You get that box phi bar j bar. Well, this is a scalar component, but I'm using the same notation. That this is well minus k j bar I d2 w by d phi I d phi l f l and so on. So I just went through this because it's useful later on. So I just went through this because this way of, I mean, it's the easiest way of getting the equation of motion is to start from the superspace action and just vary the superspace integral with respect to the superfield. So that's my lightning review of global supersymmetry. Any questions? So now I want to motivate corresponding supergravity action. Okay, so so global supersymmetry is the invariance under supertranslations, constant supertranslations. Then the G M going to Z M minus psi M, where Z is now I'm going to define a superspace coordinate Zm, which is space-time coordinate Xm and theta male, the thetas and the theta bars. And dot the complex conjugate. So local supersymmetry is simply the requirement that that the theory is invariant and supertranslations when psi is space-time dependent. So psi is taken to be psi of x. Now remember that the anticommutator of two q's gives you a space-time translation. So if you are taking local supersymmetric transformations, then you would expect to generate general coordinate transformations. And so necessarily we have to generalize from supersymmetry to supergravity. We need to discuss, we need to include gravity because we are generating coordinate transformations, general coordinate transformations. And it turns out that, so if I have theta mu going to theta mu minus psi mu of x and theta bar mu dot going to theta bar mu dot minus psi bar mu dot of x, then the corresponding xm goes to xm minus I theta sigma m psi bar x minus psi x sigma m theta bar. It's so now one just follows the standard construction of general coordinate actions, except now you want to generalize this to superspace, so you want something which is invariant under local supergravity, under supergravity transformations. So the procedure is to introduce, well, because we have fermions, we necessarily need some frame. We need to introduce these field binds. So to introduce some EA field bind one forms, which are DZ M times E M A Z. And these things are E M A E A N is delta M N. And E A M E M B is delta A B. These field bind transforms. So I've introduced now this capital, the letters from the beginning of the alphabet are supposed to be the frame indices, the frame model indices, and from the middle of the alphabet and the corresponding simple letters, M, N, etc. the space-time indices or the Einstein indices. Okay, so and so these things transform under a superspace translation. EMA is the standard transformation, generalization of the superspace, say L dL EMA, so this is just the derivative, minus dm psi L in superspace plus dLA. And then there is, I should have written this, I should rewrite this on this board. There is also a Lorentz transformation acting on the index A. I should have put this, let me cut out the box here. So Lorentz transformation, which is so delta Lorentz here of EA is EV LBA, where the LBA is as components LAB, which are the acting on the vector indices, and then on fermionic indices, we have similarly alpha beta on the, this is the spinner representation, and alpha dot beta dot the anti-spinner representation. Okay, so those are the components of the Lorentz group. You introduce a connection, one form. So connection one form phi, which is dgm times phi m, where phi m is a matrix. Phi m is a matrix. I may not always underline this, but this is a matrix. That's to signify the fact that this is a matrix. Its components are phi m. Should I write it A, B? Well, these are Lorentz indices or frame indices. Okay, so that's the usual, that's the generalization of the usual spin connection. So this thing transforms as phi L minus L phi by minus D L under local Lorentz transformations. They are all kind of sign. Well, when you interchange these things, the sign depends on whether you're taking the fermionic or the vector components and so on. I'm not going to go into all those details. If anyone is interested, they should read the relevant chapter of West and Bagger. And then you define a torsion. Torsion two form, which is TA. which is dE. And the usual definition, dE plus omega h e raised omega e b times pi dA, which is, well, I read this out explicitly, it could be dVm, dVn, t and m, A, which I can also write in the frame notation as in the frame basis as ECEB times GBCA. In flat space, the field band is not quite zero. It is, well, it's not just delta, it's not just the Kronecker delta, because of the fact that we need to define the derivative which commutes with or anti-commutes with supersymmetric is the big B generator. So there is a kind of a covariant derivative already in the spin space. So the big D A can be defined. So this frame is defined as A N D by D Z N, where the spinner components here would be, should be those d's over there. So the alpha here is this d by d theta alpha plus whatever, plus some sigma times dm. So the consequence is that that this thing here, which is well, dMA dVm, has non-trivial components. So this guy here, dMA, is so the EAM is just the ordinary Kronecker delta, but E alpha M, for instance, is I times sigma alpha alpha dot times theta bar alpha dot. Theta bar is and so on, and an important consequence there is that even in flat space, I can always find coordinates such that the connection is zero. However, the torsion is not zero in superspace, even in flat superspace. So in flat space, can choose coordinates to set phi equals zero, but torsion is still non-zero. In fact, these two components, T alpha beta dot, so if we work out the torsion equation, because of the fact that I have these non-trivial field binds, so I find that T alpha beta dot C equals T beta dot alpha C is 2i times sigma alpha beta dot C. It's all others vanish. All other components vanish. That's flat space. Uh, Okay, so if you go beyond batch phase, you can just continue pursuing the usual story, define a curvature now in the usual way. So define curvature. These are I should do a vector now, I guess, because d phi plus phi edge phi. I'm skipping over a lot of details about how the wedge product is defined and so on, okay? Because, but you should read with some background if you want all the details. I'm just giving you the general flavor of how these things are done. And now the hard part of supergravity is imposing these torsion constraints. So, yeah, as I said, even in flat spins, flat space torsion is not zero. So it turns out that these things were derived by the process of trial and error. So it turns out that the appropriate torsion constraints to apply in general are that, well, that these particular components will remain like that. But of course now you can't make all the others vanish. Some of them are non-vanishing. So at the end of the day, when you solve for these so you need to, what you need to do is to solve the standard Bianchi identities, namely that did I define the Fourier derivative? So the TA was defined as, let me rewrite that, dA plus the E wedge phi dA, which is same thing as the Fourier derivative, which I will call delta, acting on the EA. So the curvature then is simply is related to this covariant derivative of the EA by the standard. So this is the same, the usual thing. You take d, little d of this, and then replace dE by this again, and d phi by r. Okay, and then you get this standard Bianchi identity, that this is dTA plus ED times R dA. So you need to solve this subject to the torsion constraints. And at the end of the day, so this is where I'm going to skip over a lot, huge amount of work. I did actually check some of these identities, but long, long time ago, about 20 years ago, when I was much younger. But hey, maybe there's some students here who might want to check out these. So you have, what you get is that the minimum number of independent components of E and A, E the usual field bind, then a gravitino, and its complex conjugate. Then an auxiliary field m of x, and another scalar auxiliary field m of x, and a vector auxiliary field b, which is real. And it turns out that all components of the torsion and the curvature to form. So this is curvature two form with Lorentz indices. So this is B. This guy here. So this can be expressed in terms of the following set. A superfield which I will call R, which is a scalar superfield, and it turned out to be a chiral scalar superfield, and one vector superfield. I mean, this is the same as a vector superfield. I mean, you can convert between the spinor notation and the vector notation by using the sigma matrix. And another superfield which has three Fermionic indices and these are supposed to be symmetric under the interchange of these indices, which are subject to the following. It's a chiral. So the R is subject to a chiralytic condition. So now remember, in flat superspace, the chiralytic condition was simply the D bar alpha dot on phi equals 0. This is in flat space. So this needs to be generalized to a covariant P bar, I think, including this connection phi equal to 0. So that's my new chirality condition. So this is equal to 0. Something I did forgot to mention in discussing flat superspace. So from the fact that D bar cubed in flat space is 0, simply because there are only two thetas, right? So I'm multiplying phi up. If I take a cube, then I repeat one of them. So this becomes 0. And therefore, d bar squared, is a chiral projector in flat space. In other words, d bar squared times any field, superfield is a chiral superfield. So here the corresponding chiral projector involves a connection, involves this R field, and so it's not enough to take the square of that. The cube of that is not 0. Unfortunately, because you have this non-trivial connection in the delta. So the corresponding chiral projector is d bar squared, d bar alpha dot, again the chiral projection, d bar alpha dot times d bar alpha dot minus eta, minus eta. So this object acting on any superfield gives you a chiral superfield satisfying this condition. Satisfying this condition here. Furthermore, a few other things before I leave this solution to this constraint. So also a few other things which will become useful later on. So this thing at this always means theta equals theta by equal to zero. Okay, the vertical line. So this is 1/6 times this auxiliary field which came in the complex auxiliary field M, which is part of the one of the components of the E. Then you have delta alpha delta alpha r. Again, this set to zero, theta equals zeta by equal to zero, is 1/3 of E A M E B N times the usual curvature, Riemann curvature, with two Einstein indices and two frame indices. There is other stuff here, but this is very. And finally, this is not going to be useful, but there's another one here which I will just put for completeness, that this is -1/3 b x. So this is all stuff which comes from solving this constraint. And now let me, any questions? So you can always go from one to the other using this. So now let me write down someone really prove or derive anything, but I'm just trying to motivate this supergravity action. Let me motivate this by analogy with what we had in the global supersymmetric case. And to do so, I will again use the result with the proof. This can someone get that down, please? We need to. You don't. So general matter. In discussing this, it's useful to re-express the superfield bind in terms of the following fields. We have this superfield bind. The MA component, the Einstein, the space component. In terms of HM, which is a real axial vector, And the field phi, which is called the chiral compensator, this one contains the graviton and the gravitino, plus axial vector auxiliary field. B that we had before, and the phi is the chiral compensator field, which turns out satisfies the usual chirality, the flat space chirality condition. And let me also define E. It's a superdeterminant of E MA. Which can be written in terms of phi and A. Phi and H, which I will also, which can also be written as a function of phi times phi bar. It's a curly phi. So the superdeterminant can be defined as usual determinant of, well, the superdeterminant of a supermatrix M would be a matrix with even components. They are the even R components. So this would be even R, and this would be odd even. And it can be defined as, for instance, as integral d4x d4 theta of e to the minus z prime d4z to the z prime m z would be 1 over that of m. And it can be re-expressed in terms of ordinary determinants. I'm not going to use it, so we should. So there is a useful identity which I will quote. So this is actually this is material from the Gates et al. Book. It's come useful. So you have the following identity, which is at minus a quarter b bar squared times e times any superfield L is equal to phi cubed times minus a quarter del bar squared plus 2r. Remember, del bar squared plus 8r is a chiral projector, so this is a chiral projector. acting on error. So if you set error equal to R inverse, remember this was a chiral field, then you see that you can rewrite per cube as a minus a quarter, I think this, well, minus a quarter d bar squared, then E over 2R. This identity, I believe, is called Siegel's identity. And also, if L equals W of phi, so this is the chiral function of a chiral field, the superpotential, over 2R. Then you see that a phi cube times W is, so L is W, so that's chiral, so that annihilates it, and this gives me phi cube W, and on this side I have E over D bar squared T over 2R times W. So remember that we have alpha dot phi, these are chiral fields, so these are alpha dot W, so 0. In other words, I can rewrite an integral, so an integral like this, d for x, d for theta, of this, so the purpose of, so this guy is, of course, plays the role of the usual density, the square root of g, so that's the one which usually comes in when you integrate, so that defines an integration on superspace, that gives you invariant integration in superspace. So d for x, d for theta, and if I have E over 2R, then that's equivalent to what you usually think of as a chiral superspace integral by Q and W by. So in some sense, well, this is like a chiral density. So we can now sort of, well, motivate a supergravity action. So the general chiral scalar action. So this looks, so I write down something which is very similar to what we wrote down for the global case, except that I have these densities E, which is function of H and phi, and here I write, put this up in the exponential, plus then d6d, chiral superspace integrals, pi cubed w plus 6 conjugate. We note that kappa is Newton's constant, kappa is kappa squared is 8 pi g. Okay. As kappa goes to zero, the one here will vanish because this is kappa goes to zero and e goes to one, and phi goes to one. So the one here will vanish because of the d theta integrals here. The leading term here will, so the kappa squared cancels that and the three cancels, and you get k, which is what we had in the global superspace case. And this, of course, looks the same as what we had, except for this pi cubed term. Well, pi goes to 1, so this is just the usual superpotential attack. So we recover global substitute reaction.
Here's what you mean by general. So even in the global Suzy action,
yeah,
you wrote down what seemed to me very general, but then at the end of the day, your equations of motion were still second order, if I'm not mistaken.
By general, I mean after say two derivatives. We are discussing. Yeah, I'm never going to go beyond two derivatives. I mean,
it's not obvious to me because the number of derivatives seems to be tied to the integral of d theta. So in other words, you have d 4 theta, which gave you d squared, d bar squared, and so the trivial how you go to higher order equations of motion.
No, at this point, all this is this is entirely geared to two derivative actions. I'm not going to be discussing high derivative actions. This will just give you two derivative actions. I'm not. Do you want to ask? I mean, it's a question whether I can extend.
I was just wondering how you would make it. It's not obvious to me how you would.
No, it's not obvious to me either. I mean, certainly for the scalar, kind of scalars, I'm not quite sure if anybody does anyone know this superspace formalism, whether you can write down. Well, I think, well, people, I'm not sure. You mean higher R squared terms and so on in a superspace formulation?
Or just a scalar? I mean, can you have four? I mean, like, instead of box pi plus zero.
Yeah. Scalar. No, I'm not sure. I think that should be enough. But I mean, in global supersymmetry, you should be able to write down this. I don't really intend. But it must be much more complicated to supergravity. I don't know. I really haven't thought about it. So one more thing that you can note that using some of these identities that we had before, you will note that this term here gives you the Einstein action. This one is minus 3 over kappa squared times, using that identity, where is it? Up there. With L equals 1. And and replace the d theta bar squared by the d bar squared. So this becomes then a d6z times the d bar squared acting on the e, which I replace from the right hand side of the identity as with 2r. And then somewhere I had this guy. So the d2 theta acting on this is a d squared, and the d squared acting on the r gives me the usual Ricci scalar. So this is just 1 over 2 kappa squared times integral d4 x e times the Ricci scalar plus on the star. Okay? So we've used here the fact that we've used a few other things here that phi q. The reading component here is the usual determinant, and we use that identity. Maybe that's a good place to stop. So next time I'll. So this is funny. I haven't derived this. I've just motivated this. So next time I'll start from here and get the potential for the scalars. You want to move? I can give you. Derive the solution. Solve the Prussian constraint.